This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of October 23rd. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. We've all heard that old saying, one step forward, two steps back. Well, it may seem we're giving struggling homeowners a leg up, but just as soon as we try solving their problems, others keep joining them on that rickety staircase. And now we're learning that all those people we thought were being helped still can't get their footing. I'm Bob Moon, in for Tess Viglin. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today.
This economic mess started with the subprime mortgage crisis. People couldn't afford their mortgages, banks tightened credit. The rest is history, right? Well, it would be, except we're still there. The ratings agency Fitch said this week that over half of all mortgages modified to help people stay in their homes go right back into default in a matter of months. Seems we're on a mortgage treadmill, and that does not spell relief for the economy. Barry Ritholtz of Fusion IQ joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I'm visualizing trying to hold back a big landslide that just keeps coming and coming, and then just when you think you have it controlled, there's another slide somewhere else. What do these numbers really mean for regular people and for the broader economy?
Well, understand what we're looking at when we talk about a mortgage modification. We begin with a homeowner, or as some people call them, a homeowner, that's in a house but doesn't have a whole lot of equity. The house is now worth considerably less than what they paid. And their mortgage, which they were hoping to either refinance or somehow work around, has become an onerous burden. So they've been unable to get out from behind too much house. And so you end up with a series of incentives and a series of steps designed to prevent foreclosures from taking place. But the bottom line is many people are in homes they just can't afford, and there's not a whole lot you can do to prevent a foreclosure unless you reduce the amount that's owed. And very few banks seem to be willing to do that.
And if these numbers don't change, then we are just going to continue to see more and more defaults?
The foreclosure picture looks fairly negative for the next, let's call it 12 to 24 months. We're now absorbing about 300,000 foreclosures a month. That's a pretty severe number compared to historical norms, about 3 million a year. I wouldn't be surprised to see another 5 million foreclosures before housing really stabilizes and gets healthy.
I thought that we had all these programs in place, though, that were supposed to not just stop foreclosures, but keep them from happening in the future.
What the data has shown us is that when they enter one of these modification programs, that on average, somebody without real delinquency in their mortgages who go through a modification, about 50 to 60% of those people end up 12 to 18 months back in behind the eight ball on their mortgage. And people who go into a mod already delinquent 30, 60, 90 days behind, they're going into foreclosure at very high rates, at 75 to 80%.
So this number, over half of all modified mortgages going back into default after only a few months, should that be telling us something?
Yeah, it's telling us that modifications aren't going to work unless you're going to make the house appreciably less expensive for that homeowner. For most people that are going through modifications, it's just a temporary stopgap. It doesn't solve the underlying problem. These minor changes around the margins, you know, lower interest rates a little bit, reduce the payment slightly because we're extending the term of the mortgage, they're not addressing the fundamental issue, which is literally millions of people ended up buying houses that they can no longer afford.
What I hear you saying is, let's stop postponing the inevitable.
It wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to just tear the Band-Aid off, let house prices get back to their normal levels relative to traditional metrics. I know it sounds cold, and if you've ever spoken to anybody who's gone through a foreclosure, it's a miserable, miserable experience. But from a macro perspective, looking at the entire country, it would be healthy for the economy to see foreclosures go forward, to see home prices normalize. That will lead to more housing activity, and that helps to create jobs. Until we start seeing house prices get to a point that's going to cause more activity in the real estate sector. The whole economy is just more or less muddling along.
Barry Ritholtz with the online research firm Fusion IQ, the author of Bailout Nation. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
A lot of the healthcare debate moved behind closed doors on Capitol Hill this week. Public option in, public option out, or maybe back in again. And will insurance companies lose the legal protections that currently allow them to get together to set prices? You may not know it, but there are things you, the consumer, can do in the meantime to set your own prices. For one thing, you can negotiate your medical costs. Mark Rukovina of the Access Project is here to tell us how that can work. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Bob.
So I am used to haggling over a car or that old easy chair at the flea market. But you can really make your best offer to a doctor?
Well, many people are surprised to learn that medical bills are in fact negotiable. While all patients might be charged the same fee, not all are expected to pay the same fee.
What are some of the more common things that people might try to negotiate?
Hospitals, doctors, other providers, including ambulance companies, lab fees. For any bill that a patient has, they should approach the provider about charity care or a discount for those fees. Many providers offer what is called a prompt pay discount, which is payment at or near the time of service or once the bill is generated. And if people have the resources to take advantage of that, they should be encouraged to do so.
Now, how do you know what a fair price is for a particular procedure?
Well, what a fair price is a very difficult question to answer. Good data on pricing and pricing and quality are difficult to find. However, as I said earlier, prices are negotiable, so people that need procedures and have bills that they're struggling to pay should ask for a discount for those procedures.
Let's say you didn't set a price up front. Is it possible to talk down the bill once you get it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. People should first look at their bills and make sure that they're being billed for services that they did in fact receive. If they have questions about the bills they've received, they can ask for a detailed itemized bill from their providers. If there's anything on there that seems suspicious, they should pursue that first with the provider, possibly with their private insurer or the public insurance program that they may be covered by.
Now, is this kind of haggling something that mostly people who don't have insurance do, or do people who have insurance actually engage in this?
Well, increasingly, in this economy, people with insurance are engaging in these negotiations as well. Many insured people have a lot of upfront costs that they're expected to pay, very large deductibles or very large co-payments. And again, in talking with providers, oftentimes you can negotiate down those fees.
Now, you help people negotiate medical bills all the time. Is this just about the price, or is it about more than that?
Well, it's primarily people are contacting us for help around the price. They have medical bills that they're struggling to pay. Many of them have exhausted their savings and still come up short in terms of paying back those bills in full. But it is, in fact, about empowering consumers around the kind of care that they're receiving and the cost that they pay for that care.
Mark Rukovina is executive director of the Access Project, a nonprofit that helps people negotiate their medical costs. Thanks very much for the valuable information.
Thanks.
Have you ever tried negotiating your health care bills? Let us know how it turned out. Our website is marketplace.org, and this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
I'm the kind of guy who believes in insurance for everything. So when the COBRA extension on my health insurance ran out, I assumed I would shop around and find an individual policy.
Freelance writer and journalist Duncan Moore decided to voluntarily join the ranks of people in this country living without health insurance. Here's why.
The prospect of paying $600 a month in premiums got me thinking real hard. I rarely go to the doctor. I don't smoke, don't drink too much, and don't use illegal drugs. I'm 53, single, with no dependents, in good mental health. If I were going to get a chronic disease, like diabetes or high blood pressure or asthma, I'd have it by now. I exercise a lot and eat right. I don't play contact sports and I don't rollerblade. I'm probably not going to break my arm or sprain my ankle. My folks, by the way, are 82 and 80, and they're going strong. So, as of this week, I have been one full year without health insurance coverage. No premiums, no copays, no deductibles, no incomprehensible statements in the mail, just pay as you go. With health insurance, I would have paid at least $6,000 in premiums, plus any deductibles and copays. As it stands, my total personal outlay for medical care in the past 12 months, $175. I went to the doctor for a checkup and told him I didn't have insurance. He trimmed the office visit fee from $100 down to $65, and he cut the fee for the blood and urine tests from $195 down to $110. That's a pretty good deal. But you're probably thinking, wait a minute, what about the risk of major illness, like cancer? What if I get hit by a bus? What if I'm unlucky? Well, I have about $50,000 in savings that I'm ready to pay out if I need to. Beyond that, I'm definitely taking a risk. But let's face it, even with insurance, there's risk. Insurers don't always live up to their promises. If you have heart surgery or a cancer diagnosis, the insurance company can pour through your medical records and find some little niggling hangnail in your history. Then they declare that you actually had a pre-existing condition and they're not going to pay. They get away with whatever they can. To be honest, I shouldn't be allowed to do what I'm doing. Everybody should be in the pool for health insurance. But if the insurers have the freedom to deny claims after the fact, then I'm glad I have the freedom not to buy what they're selling. It's not a freedom I want, however. I'd rather have good, guaranteed health insurance with no pre-existing condition exclusions that I can afford. Until then, I'm on my own.
Duncan Moore is a writer and journalist living in Chicago. You can order a lot of what you need to run a business on the web, right down to supplies and advertising. Or you could even take it a step further and just buy the whole business online.
Retail shops, restaurants, gas stations, dry cleaners, those kinds of businesses. We have manufacturing businesses, internet businesses, and other lines.
The business of selling businesses. Up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And now we've come to my favorite part of the program, getting personal. The part where we take your personal finance questions. This week we're focusing on questions involving housing and mortgages. There's never been a better time. And who better to take those questions than our old friend Nick Britsinas. He's director of Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Hi, Nick.
Nice to be with you.
Nick, are you ready to answer some questions?
We'll try.
Okay. First we have Patty on the phone from Baldwinville, New York. Hi, Patty.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. What's your question for us today?
Well, my sister, my father, and I jointly bought a cottage in the Finger Lakes wine region of New York State. And my sister and I took out a very small mortgage. And in August of this year, we got a letter from the new mortgage company because our mortgage had been sold. We got the letter from the new bank giving us information on how to contact them. We found that the new company paid the county property taxes in the amount of $3,000. However, the old company, which was TBW, had paid them already when they were due. So this has caused a shortfall in the escrow account.
Dear Patty, welcome to your nightmare.
Absolutely.
Nick, what can you tell her to help her out?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry to hear all of that. It's very unfortunate when servicers, where lenders, where agents are really not doing what they're supposed to do, which is to keep track of these necessary payments. This is a valid concern, and it certainly sounds valid. They have violated a federal law, and that federal law is called RESPA, or Real Estate Settlement and Procedures Act. Of course, your first line of defense, which you're already trying, is try to reach the company directly. The second line of defense, if you needed to do that, is really to file a complaint. The administering agency for RESPA is the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD.
Okay.
And the specific office within HUD is the Office of General Counsel. Most of the RESPA oversight is done in their Washington office.
Nick, do they need to get a lawyer?
They don't need to get a lawyer. Now, understand, HUD receives many, many complaints, but this is a relatively sort of straightforward sort of complaint.
We have sent a certified letter to the new company stating that this was a qualified written request and sending all the documentation to them about how there had been the overpayment and that sort of thing.
I would definitely send a copy of that letter to HUD because that sort of demonstrates that you are acting in good faith.
Okay.
Does that start a clock at all for this, Nick?
It's not a clock, but all complaints are responded to. Now, the first response will be to say what you've already done, which is contact the lender. And sometimes, to be honest with you, Bob, sometimes merely sending the letter to sort of HUD and having HUD make the inquiry of the lender might get the attention that you so far have not been able to get.
I suspect, Nick, this is pretty common with loans being sold as much as they are these days.
It's common, but it really shouldn't be, because in the selling of the loans, which is perfectly valid, again, there is that responsibility of the new servicer of the loan to carry that information. So the fact that these loans are bought and sold is really not an excuse for letting something drop.
Okay.
Good luck to you, Patty.
Good luck.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay, next we have Sarah on the phone in Santa Cruz, California. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
What's your question for us today?
Well, I have a question about my mortgage. In 2006, my husband and I bought a home here in Santa Cruz, and we bought it with one of those terrible loans that they don't give anymore with 100% financing and stated income and the whole bit. And at the time that we bought the house, we tried to be as smart as we could be about getting a dumb loan. And so we have one of our loans is 80% of the amount of the house, amount of the mortgage, and that's an interest-only loan, and it's 7 years interest-only, and then it'll start adjusting. And the second loan is 30 years amortized. And so what we did when we bought the house is I figured out how much we would need to overpay on the second mortgage so that it would be paid off by the time the first mortgage begins to adjust in 2013.
Sounds pretty complicated. Nick, can you help sort it out?
It is complicated, and the problem is you have two mortgages, and I suspect that you're wondering whether or not the value of the house is going to be enough to pay off those two mortgages. Is that part of the problem?
Basically, my question is whether I should continue to overpay on the second loan because we've lost a lot of value on the house. Our obligation on that second mortgage is $900 a month, and we pay $1,500.
Well, and that if you can afford to pay off that early mortgage, you should do so. The other option you might want to consider is contact the servicer, whoever is servicing that mortgage. We have found in these days, in these stressful times we are in, that servicers can be a little more flexible. So there might be a possibility, for example, depending what your own resources are, to make some kind of smaller lump sum payment to avoid that obligation sort of completely. This is a time of negotiation, and clearly when you're in a situation where you are potentially paying more than the home is worth, it could be susceptible to that kind of negotiation.
I'm intrigued by that, Nick. You're suggesting that this is the time, if you really need to make a deal, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, these are the times the lenders are all very skeptical about the values of their mortgage. So if you can offer an exit strategy for both them and you, they might be amenable to listening.
Sarah, that help you out?
Yes, it does. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Well, good luck to
you. You're welcome. Good luck.
If you have questions, we have answers or at least some advice to lead the way. Give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or write us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. We'll be back with more questions and more of Nick Retsinas later in the show. If you're unemployed or afraid of becoming unemployed, you might be browsing the web for job listings. Well, here's another idea. Maybe just landing a new job isn't the answer. Why not become your own boss? Turns out you can look for that online, too. Several websites list businesses for sale. Think of them as a kind of entrepreneurial Craigslist. Of course, buying a business online is a little complicated. Marketplace's Eve Tro learned how it works.
For the past 2 years, Jill Bernheimer's sold wine over the internet. She worked from a small office where she shipped bottles to customers, but she recently opened her own brick-and-mortar wine shop in Los Angeles called Domain LA.
So I'll give you a peek. They're really beautiful wine racks that are custom-made out of sustainable black American walnut.
There's also recessed lighting, comfy couches, and a library of wine books. Pretty fancy for a place that was a mini-mart just about 6 months ago. Bernheimer had to reinvent the space, but she was thrilled to find it. It's not easy to find good retail space with a liquor license in L.A.
I was looking for a good 6 to 9 months, did the traditional look at for rent signs around town.
No luck. Then Jill, who, remember, is a web entrepreneur, thought, if you can buy wine online, why not a wine store? She stumbled upon a website called bizben.com. It lists businesses for sale in California.
I found this listing probably within the first two times I used BizBen on a search.
Websites that offer these searches come in many forms. Some are the online classified ads from newspapers, or they might be the listings of a real estate broker who specializes in small businesses. The site bizbysell.com is the largest place to buy and sell businesses online. It's been around for about 13 years. General Manager Mike Handelsman says it covers just about everything.
Retail shops, restaurants, gas stations, dry cleaners, those kinds of businesses. We have manufacturing businesses, internet businesses, and other lines. And they go up to many million dollars in annual revenue and sale price.
He says the appeal of these sites is the same as any online marketplace, reach. Anyone, any place can look at the ads at any time. Take Jason Lubin. He sold his San Francisco area software company, Trigram, to a guy in Cleveland. He wanted to spend more time on his real job, doing acupuncture.
I was much more passionate about Chinese medicine and doing acupuncture than I was about doing software. And the software came about sort of as an accident.
But software was just what Jonathan Schultz was looking for. He'd worked in the field for a few startup companies, and he was ready to run his own venture. He'd been browsing ads online for years.
I've always had some interest in moving from an employee position to an owner position, and I found it kind of fun to browse and see what was available.
Schultz bought the company, and it took just one visit in person to seal the deal.
I can't imagine how else I would have come across Jason and Trigram without utilizing internet brokerage.
But not all online business sales go this smoothly. The online directories don't validate or vet the ads. Buyers have to do their homework. Some ads are placed directly by owners. Many are posted by brokers. Owners and brokers can be stingy with information in the ads because they don't want to reveal too many specifics until you show you're a serious buyer. Jill Bernheimer, she's the one who bought the mini-mart-turned-wine store, says it was often hard to sift through the ads.
A lot of the locations are far-flung. A lot of brokers are asking for considerably more than a business is worth.
Bernheimer hired a lawyer to protect her in her deal. She thoroughly checked out the store before she signed anything. But the mini-mart still came with a lot of things she didn't want for a wine store.
There's a lotto terminal in the back that I haven't been able to get the California State Lottery Board to come pick up. I think they're hoping that maybe I'll sell lotto tickets and fine wine.
Not an option for you?
I don't think I'm going to pursue that revenue stream.
But maybe there's someone online who will. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace Money.
Here's another kind of business you can conduct on the web. You know those sites where you check out the reputation of the apartment or restaurant or other business you might be curious about? Unbiased feedback is helpful, and hey, it's free. But some reviews are anything but unbiased. Many are 100% absolute fake. I'm shocked, I tell you, shocked. Sally Herships reports.
I think I want to try it on.
Yeah.
Marianne Sullivan has owned a bridal shop in Orange County, California for 25 years. Since a lot of her business, she says, comes from referrals, it seems like a lot of her customers must be happy. But she says it can be hard to tell.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Bye.
Nice to meet you, ladies.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Girls are always there. They don't always speak up and speak their mind.
Customers may not speak their mind face-to-face, but they do when they have the anonymity of the internet. Sullivan had never checked out the online ratings for her store until a year and a half ago. When she did, she was shocked.
Well, They're horrible reviews. They were the worst ratings, 1.5 stars.
At first, Sullivan started reading the reviews to find out if there was anything she could improve on. But she was in for another surprise.
They weren't the truth. They were fictional, and they were just downright deliberately mean and slanderous.
Something seemed off, so Sullivan's husband started doing some online sleuthing. He noticed all the bad reviews were written on the same day with the same spelling errors. Turns out, he says, the negative reviews all came from the same computer, and it was tracked back to a competitor. Marianne Sullivan was able to get some of the bad reviews removed, but not all. The review sites where they were posted said they have no way to tell who's right and who's wrong. Sullivan says there is an alternative for businesses who get slammed online, but she says it can backfire.
I have a friend who also has a bridal shop up north, and she tries to respond, and I've read what she's written, and she just sounds defensive and angry, and it isn't pretty.
Sounding defensive and angry in responses risks losing even more business. And with wedding dresses going for $1,000 or $2,000 a pop, that's an expensive proposition. But buying a wedding dress is an expensive proposition too, which is why potential customers often do online research before hitting stores. But how can they be sure what they're reading is accurate? Christine Fritchen is editor-in-chief at ConsumerSearch.com, a product review site. She's always on the lookout for fake reviews.
They have 15 five-star reviews and 11 one-star reviews.
That seems like a bit of an imbalance. And a strong split in the ratings with no shades of gray, says Fritchen, is another tip-off. Reviews are duds. If you click on a lemon, it's obvious.
Lipoblast is amazing. I feel great, look great, and so much more confidence. It's truly wonderful to wake up each morning and feel energized and good about myself. Magic is the best word I can use to describe Lipoblast.
Fritchen says odds are glowing reviews like this one, with no downsides for the item listed, have been written by a manufacturer to boost sales. She says it's the poor reviews that deserve our attention. They come from real consumers who feel frustrated for some reason. You can also tell, Fritchen says, whether a review is genuine just by clicking on the reviewer's name. The author of this review has only posted once.
For Lipoblast Extreme and nothing else. Suspicious to say the least.
When I shop, I usually check online reviews, and I find this kind of boosterism all over the internet. But is it illegal? New York lawyer Joe Rosenbaum says employees of a company that make a certain product are free to share an opinion, so long as it's their own.
And as long as nobody's forcing you to say that, nobody's coercing you to say that, nobody's incentivizing you to say that, perfectly legal.
But if you work for the same company and are paid or told to promote a product, Rosenbaum says it is still okay, but disclosure is key.
If I know that you are selling cars and that you make a living on commission selling cars, I may still believe you, but I may want to ask several other people who I know are not in this business to confirm your view.
Rosenbaum says as long as reviewers disclose who they are, so consumers have the ability to judge their credibility, it's perfectly legal. It's when reviewers don't reveal their relationship to a company that the law may be broken. But he says current laws are outdated. They don't cover new media as much as we'd like. The FTC is working on updating legislation, but in the meantime, it's up to consumers and businesses to decide what to believe. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Got some online feedback for us? Fire away, nicely please, at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I sure didn't expect to see the spate of stories we saw this past week about what I'll diplomatically call conspicuous consumption. The week began with word that Neiman Marcus had sold out of 50 limited edition Jaguars, just 4 hours after they officially went on sale in the department store's famous annual holiday catalog. We checked with Pam Danziger, a retail consultant with Unity Marketing, and she assured us this kind of outrageous fortune is not the norm in these recessionary times.
Affluent consumers are very aware of the cultural changes that are going on, and they're really calling upon themselves to be responsible consumers.
Then again, if they're suffering from withdrawal and need a quick fix, the new Neiman Marcus catalog is still dealing. Yeah, there's an amphibious two-seat aircraft at $250,000 a pop with a description that says, "You've earned something special." But Ginger Reeder told us she was careful not to get too carried away about putting together this year's Christmas book.
It does reflect what's going on in the world. I don't think I could have avoided paying attention to that, you know, subconsciously. But consciously, I did not see anything over the top. Or, you know, there were no $10 million yachts being introduced that came across my desk.
We spotted another possible reason for that at the end of the week in the Wall Street Journal. Recent studies are showing shoppers, especially rich ones, are feeling increasingly guilty these days. Martin Lindstrom is a branding expert and the author of a book called Buyology, that's spelled with a B-U-Y. And he explains it's not just their own financial setbacks that are causing rich consumers to change their habits.
They have this kind of complex dilemma. On one hand, they want to spend money. On the other hand, they don't dare to do that because they feel guilty that they can afford it and no one else can afford it.
So just maybe when they're thumbing through this Neiman Marcus Christmas book and they get here to page 153, they'll take a look at this $4,400 nativity set and marble-based creche and perhaps ask themselves, what would Jesus do? The early bird used to get the worm when it came to cheap holiday airfares, but this year it may be more of a waiting game than a mad scramble.
I think that they're going to have some sales. I think if you check fares once a day, twice a day, three times a day, if you're really, you know, diligent, you're going to find a deal.
We've got tips to get you on top of holiday travel. That's coming up later. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. 'Twas 2 months before Christmas, and what should appear but airfares climbing higher at just the wrong time of year. Or the right time, I guess, if you're an airline exec who hopes to keep the bottom line from being a wreck. We've got just a ticket, though, to make it home with aplomb. George Hobica keeps an eye on things at airfarewatchdog.com. George, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Bob.
I'm going to be staying put for the holidays. How much do I represent the traveling public?
Well, I think if the fares stay as high as they are, then a lot of people are going to be staying put. We've been looking at certain routes and fares, and my God, they are so high on some routes. Just recently, the fares seem to have spiked. The thing is that if you wait and if you're patient and you look and you shop and you search, you might find that fares are going to go down on certain routes.
And are there deals to be had out there?
They are spot deals here and there. I'll give you an example. We were looking at Newark, New Jersey to San Francisco on Friday, and the fares were about $600. And then they went down to on Saturday to about $400. And then on Sunday, the same route, nonstop flights with tax, were about $329. So fares are not static, and the number of seats available at every lower fare is not static. They change all the time.
Well, I think that brings up a good question. Does the old rule of buying early still apply in the airline business, or should you wait and see?
What I'm telling people is that if you see a fare on a route where you want to go and it's affordable to you, you might as well buy it. But if it's outrageous, I would wait. I think that they're going to have some sales. I think if you check fares once a day, twice a day, three times a day, if you're really, you know, diligent, you're going to find a deal.
Now, if you are going to buy the ticket now, does that mean that you're locking in the fare necessarily, or will the airline still adjust that downward if the fare happens to go down?
Well, there are still three airlines, Alaska, JetBlue, and Southwest, that will give you a credit if the fare drops between the time you buy and the time you fly. The credits in the form of a voucher are good for future travel. So if you're, you know, if you want to hedge your bets, you might as well book travel on those airlines if you can.
Now, you watch these things all the time. Give me some insider tips here. How can I know that I'm getting a good deal?
I think people need to look at alternate airports and alternate airlines. For example, if you're flying from the Chicago area to Orlando, there's a little airline called Allegiant Airlines that flies from Rockford, Illinois to Orlando Sanford. And last time we looked, the fares on Allegiant for peak holiday travel were about $100 each way, and they were $500 on the major airlines. So think of, you know, smaller airports, smaller airlines. Make sure you look at southwest.com, which does not share its fares on the major third-party booking engines.
Let me bring this full circle again. What are you noticing in terms of how many people are flying this year, and particularly around the holidays now?
Well, the statistics say that fewer people are flying. The airlines have cut anywhere from 9 to 12% capacity, but statistics say that fewer people are actually getting on planes, and there are fewer seats for them to get on anyway. So everything has gone down. So, you know, I think the best idea is to just shop around, wait until you see a great fare, and then strike when you find a great fare.
George Hobica of airfarewatchdog.com, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money. I'm Bob Moon, in for Tess Vigeland. And we're ready to take more of your housing questions. I'm here with the director of Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies, Nick Ratsinas. And, Nick, we have Thomas on the phone from San Marcos, California. Hi, Thomas.
Hi.
How can we help you today?
Yes. We've started searching for a house. My wife and I are first-time homebuyers. And we started earlier this year, and we're looking to use the FHA loan. And it seems to be a detriment to our side. We've gone through several offers, and lately they've been coming back rejected, not because we haven't offered enough, but just because we're competing against cash offers. And we're trying to figure out if there's a way to make the FHA look more inviting for the seller.
I thought FHA loans were supposed to be a good deal on both sides, Nick. Not so?
Well, they are a good deal. You can understand from the point of view of the seller, given people's nervousness about whether people will actually be able to get credit, to prefer cash over any kind of credit, not just FHA, but any kind of credit at all. One way to perhaps get around this is to talk with your lender, that is, whoever is offering you the FHA insurance, and talk about pre-qualifying you, that is, walking in to the seller with a letter that says, subject to review of final documentation, you are hereby qualified for an FHA loan.
And that almost should be as good as cash, right?
Not quite as good as cash, because cash is cash. But at least it makes the FHA loan insurance a little more liquid.
We've done that several times, because many of the offers that we've made have required that you be pre-qualified with whoever the bank is they want to deal with. Okay. Part of the issue seems to be the time-lapse issue, where the cash offer can go through and they can close out faster than they can with the FHA.
Well, you're never going to outrace cash. That's always going to get to the finish line first. What it probably means is the price you're going to offer is going to have to compensate for the difference between obtaining a mortgage and cash. So it might cause you maybe to offer a little bit more than you had wanted to.
Okay, so does that help you out?
Yeah, I think we're just going to have to keep forcing our way in and see what we can come up with.
Well, the good news is it just takes one successful transaction to get you into a home, so don't lose faith.
Hang in there.
Thank you.
And next we have Tamar in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi there, Tamar.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And what's your question for us today?
I got a mortgage a few years ago and everything was fine, and then wanted to take advantage of refinance options with lower rates at this point. But because I'm a graduate student and my income is from a fellowship, I was told by a mortgage broker that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac don't consider my fellowship money income, and therefore I couldn't get a refinance. So I just wanted to ask for advice about what to do in my situation. I pay taxes on that money and live off of it, so it feels like income to me.
Nick, answer please.
and it is income, and good luck on your studies tomorrow, which is the most important thing. Refinancing is a great idea, given the historically low interest rate, so I would encourage you to do so. I think that the difficulty, perhaps, is the lender suggesting that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who would do the refinancing, are not comfortable enough that this really is going to be stable income going forward. I think what you might want to do is not only show a history of receiving the fellowship, but maybe getting a letter from either the university or the source of the fellowship that really states very clearly this fellowship will be forthcoming, assuming you meet all the terms and conditions, for X number of years.
Yeah, I showed them that. I had my fellowship commitment letter, and they said that that wasn't good enough.
Did it have the amount of money that was in there also?
It did.
I hate to say this, but they really should accept it. Once you've sort of demonstrated that, the lender should not be skittish about making those representations.
Yeah, we got a lot of skittish lenders out there, though, don't we?
Yeah, both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have an incentive to do refinancing. So I would push the mortgage representative to make that representation to him and not short-circuit it before it reached them.
But the lender has no requirement to loan the money, right?
The lender has no requirement, but in this particular case, the lender is really just making the application. The actual loan is going to be held by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. The guidelines are the guidelines of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, not the guidelines of the lender.
All right. And the lender seemed to think their people said that it wouldn't get through.
Yeah, sometimes you just have to ask. You shouldn't rule yourself out. There's enough people eventually who might say no to you in life. Don't try to guess ahead of who's going to say no and who's not.
Okay, I will maybe try again with my current bank.
Best of luck to you, Tamar.
Good luck to you, Tamar.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for questions on this week's show, but you can call and leave your question with us anytime. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or write to us. You can do that through the Getting Personal link at our website, marketplace.org. Nick Retsinas, thanks so much for helping us untangle some of these housing knots.
Well, we tried. Thank you, Bob.
Marketplace Money is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing and online surveys. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Kids and money. You've heard us talk a lot about that topic over the past few weeks, how we teach it, what they think of it, all leading up to a special live show in Portland, Oregon next month. Talking about money never seems easy, but throw in a stressful situation like a job loss, and how do you know what to tell your kids and how they'll take the news about a change in lifestyle? From Minnesota Public Radio, Annie Baxter reports.
About a year ago, the dynamic in the Kaser family started to change. Julie and Tony were living in their pretty yellow three-bedroom house in a Minneapolis suburb with their two teenage kids. They didn't think they were living extravagantly or see themselves as vulnerable. But then, last November, the dad, Tony Kaser, lost his job as a computer programmer.
Now I look for work. That's my job.
Only a month later, his wife Julie got laid off from her job as an X-ray technician. Julie says their 13-year-old son Travis knew that meant they'd lose the house.
Travis got off the bus and I met him at the door and he just started bawling. Your home? You got laid off too? He knew. You didn't even have to tell him, you know.
Julie's found some part-time work, but it's not enough to pay the mortgage. She says the kids don't blame the parents for the situation. They're just sad.
They realize it was really no fault of our own.
But that's the first of several places where the kids' perceptions diverge a bit from the parents. 19-year-old Ashley Kaser does have a lot of sympathy for her parents. She believes they didn't do anything to lose their jobs and that they're trying hard to find new ones. But she wishes her parents had set money aside, not just for a financial crisis like this one, but also for her college education. She's a sophomore at the University of Minnesota, and it's paying her own way.
Yes, I'm actually a little upset about it just because I hear about all my friends who have their parents who have saved since the time they were two, and it feels like that's a parent's job. Not to pay for it all, I don't think that at all, but to think about it when you're growing up.
The Kasers admit they could have saved more. Maybe taken fewer trips, not built a deck on the back of the house. But Tony doubts that would have fended off foreclosure.
We see on the news a lot of people that, you know, they had good 6-8 months worth of savings set aside and they're in the same situation. And now they're going to lose their homes and things too.
And Julie says, in the end, family is really more important than money. It's crucial that they hang together at this tough time. But the kids have some different takes on that message as well. Ashley, for example, has a surprisingly sweet complaint for a 19-year-old. She thinks her parents could be more focused on the family right now.
I wish my parents would do more stuff with us now that they have more time to do more stuff with us. Granted, you don't have the money to go out all the time, but you can still hang out and be together, I guess. they don't do much of that.
And Travis, the 13-year-old, sees another version of home life through his little wireframe glasses. His parents used to indulge his requests for new school clothes and supplies without a thought. But now, those requests can fuel debate.
I still want to know what is so big about this particular calculator.
It's got the graphing things.
Problem is, the calculator costs $80.
I just want to be spending money every single year for the calculator.
The family still ends up laughing over these conversations. But Julie and Tony admit tensions have flared since their layoffs. And Travis has taken note of the bickering.
It's mainly about how one is supposedly lazy and the other is feeling like they've been working their butt off and they don't get any appreciation for it.
Teens really observe what adults are doing.
That's Catherine Solheim. She's a family social science professor at the University of Minnesota. Solheim says after job loss, it's tough for parents to be consistent role models for their kids. And kids pay attention when the parents fall down.
They tend to observe very, very closely what parents are doing. And so they look for that inconsistency. It's kind of a part of the growing up process and kind of figuring out who they are.
Julie Kaser's trying to figure out a lot, too. She's overwhelmed by her hunt for work. And even as she struggles, she knows the kids are watching.
I think when you're in this situation, there are good days and there are bad days. And I think the kids see that on our faces some days.
A day that's guaranteed to be bad will likely happen in March, when the Kasers will be forced to leave their home. Their options include moving into Julie's sister's basement. The Kasers have discussed the eventual move with their kids for months, to the point where Ashley and Travis say they don't want to talk about it anymore. But Julie Kaser says there's really no way to avoid the topic. Her kids keep seeing her come home with moving boxes, and they know what they're for. In Rogers, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace Money.
We've been asking you, our listeners, for your stories about childhood and money, what your parents taught you or didn't, what you're teaching your kids or not. This week, Jason Priest and his 13-year-old daughter, Kennedy, talk about how they set up a mini business for Kennedy and her brother at their dad's new venture.
I have a music studio. We teach lessons for guitar, bass, drums, voice, piano.
There you go. Perfect. Right, you picked up tone. Back to G.
Since I've started my business, I've thought of ways to try to get them engaged in the business. And so I pitched the idea of if I bought a gumball machine, they could make some money. And, you know, right off the bat, both of them were very excited.
I thought it was going to be really fun, that it was going to be a challenge that I could overcome and be able to succeed at.
The whole concept of credit was that I would purchase the gumball machine for them, and then they would pay me back through installments. But what we found with gumball machines, especially with young kids in the studio, they will try to wrestle a gumball out without putting a quarter in, so the first gumball machine actually wore out. So then I had to buy a second gumball machine for them. So I consider the first one paid off, and now we're working on the second one.
Well, it started when he was a smaller business, and it made maybe $3 a week. But when he got to a larger status, it started making about maybe $18. Me and my brother both share half of the money. Most of it goes to our lunch money for school and breakfast money.
I hope that they will take from this how to start a business and run a business, to anticipate, you know, how many gumballs they thought they would move each week and then how much money they would have to put into paying me off for the gumball machine.
Always have money to buy more stock. It's really hard to run a business if you run out of things to sell. Also, keep money in case something breaks or is worn out. So that way, instead of having to buy a whole new thing, you could be able to buy that certain part that needs to be replaced or fixed.
It's a life lesson. You know, you just don't go out and get something for free and not have to pay it back. You know, when they're 18 or 19 and going to college, get the offers for credit cards, they know it's not just free money.
Jason Priest and his daughter Kennedy from Little Rock, Arkansas. We want your stories and your questions about kids and money. Go to our special webpage. It's marketplace.org/financialfutures. You can learn more about our special show in Portland, Oregon there, as well as get some tips from Beth and Becca Kobliner about things each wishes the other knew about money. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, more of the lessons parents can teach us about money and what happens if those lessons never come.
I was in the foster care system for about 8 years, and then I aged out. Really, I became homeless because I couldn't maintain independent responsibilities.
How to build financial independence after foster care. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and Jolie Myers. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Bob Moon. Please come back and join us next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today.
American Public Media.